I agree.
Hi, Lisa.
So I've never been to the speaker meeting, and the best part of being a speaker, never having been, is I have no idea when it's time to finally sit up here. You know, I have just a lot of feelings about being here and responses already to seeing people. And, you know, Christy, your share was, like, so amazing, because to me it was just really horrifying what you went through. And the way that you just have a natural smile on your face is pretty amazing. And I'm very different than you. I was thinking, well, they're going to get a real polarity of how we come through childhood trauma. And then, you know, just a little bit about my history with ACA. I was, I joined ACA pretty much in the first season. It began in Santa Barbara, or was restarted in Santa Barbara. I haven't been in the rooms lately at all. I attend a different program almost every day of the week, but in the morning, because I need to start my day with program. So that's why I don't know some of you, and also some kind of rationalization for why I'm here. I definitely qualify. I think I qualify more for ACA than any of the other 12-step programs I've been involved in, and I've been involved in five. So maybe I'll refer to that. But most certainly, I am the child of a really dysfunctional family, and part of the dysfunction is that it wasn't that nameable what the hell was going on, because neither of my actual parents are alcoholic. So it was such a miracle to come into ACA and see the dysfunctional description, and also say that having grandparents as alcoholic is really a qualifying experience, and so on. So, you know, one thing that I think is very formative for me is also cultural. I was born in 1968 in Northern California, just across the bridge from San Francisco, and so the Summer of Love was when I was in utero. And I grew up in that experimentation that was happening with my parents' generation. It was more my mother than my father who was really going down the road in hallucinogens and just, you know, countercultural attitudes, like just throwing the establishment away and creating a new paradigm. And that was her full focus. And so that she was surrounded by people who also had those feelings. And I have a lot of respect for that movement, because I just think it really opened the whole civilization up to new experiences and kind of brought back indigenous primality into some of our spiritual consciousness, and I was raised with that as well. And so I can refer to my childhood and the suffering that I experienced as sort of sacrificial to a greater momentum that I also espouse, and it keeps me from fitting in. That's what I was thinking when I was watching Christy. It's just like, I don't fit in. And I saw and heard someone speaking tonight who has been able to create a lot of, to my estimation, and that's part of my coping mechanism, is situating myself, you know, in relation to someone else. Like, what are they doing, and what am I not doing, or am I trying to do? And I think that when people can make a living, that is very admirable when you come out of childhood horror. And that hasn't been exactly my experience yet. I mean, it is now. It's part of my now story, but it wasn't for a long time. So having been born just sort of into that era, and then in that location, a lot of experimental, and then, you know, harder drugs like cocaine drifting around ambiently. I mean, I am by profession a clairvoyant or a psychic. So I just say that really flatline to explain that I think I was born with sensitivities that made me especially vulnerable to the wildness around me, because it wasn't as blatant a kind of terrorizing story or situation as just, for example, I keep referring to you because we just heard it. But my mom, I can't really diagnose what's going on with her, whether she maybe did take some hallucinogens, whether growing up with an alcoholic father, also her parents divorced in an era when very few did, like in around 1950 or 48. So I think that was kind of a strange burden. But she threw off the life of normalcy. We always remember to say that my mother was the class president of her college class, senior year. And that seems so illustrious. She worked with Carl Bernstein at the Washington paper that blew up Watergate. Mm-hmm. She went to New York and worked for Women's Wear Daily, and I have great pictures of her when she cared about fashion that I always wish she still cared. And then she, you know, kind of got pushed into the suburban domestic partnership life expected of women right at that crucial moment when it was no longer expected or it was, you know, rebelled against. But she kind of went down that road, and then it blew up. And it blew up right in my, you know, toddler years. And she then, you know, she got the house and the divorce of my parents, but like she didn't buy it. She sold it and didn't buy another one. And so it was like all this security built up in a very, you know, kind of the white picket way, fence way, and then suddenly just this free for all. And that was my upbringing with her as a single mom. I'm an only child, and that's been really something that was distinct because I didn't have like a peer to say, oh my God, can you believe what's going on? Or if you're my reference, this is going on, right? You know, to chat about it like kids would. So I just internalized a lot of experience watchfully that became, you know, part of my story, like an emotional burden, you know, just absorbing incidents without really ever talking about them to people. And I would also say that I became really attuned to adults because I was surrounded by them, and I became probably pretty verbally, you know, I have a good speaking vocabulary because I was listening to a lot of adults yelling, and I have a lot of emotional sensibility that seems mature, and I sort of lost childhood in that mix. I mean, that's dramatic, but we don't have hours here. There's another piece to my story, but I like to tell it chronologically, so I didn't really feel anything except terror, I keep using that word tonight, sort of traumatized by the divorce of my parents when I was 5, and then just living alone with my mom, who was poor, and the big fight between my parents. My father was a corporate attorney in San Francisco and not at all poor, and my mother was barely paying rent, so they would fight all the time about child support, and, you know, this is it just what I internalized was that they were not fighting about me or seeing me or having me, but just how much it cost to have me. So that was became this huge influence in my sense of injustice that I was born in this family where no one cared about me. And actually, I think I almost have to jump forward because it just doesn't make any sense to me anymore to not mention that when I was 37 years old, I had a physical and kind of visual memory of being molested by my father's father. So I'm kind of, it helps us track because I was so distraught about things that I think are pretty normal because I was using my child's sensibility to process trauma that I couldn't cognate, if that makes sense. I was so young, and I think it was in the dark at night, and it might have been awakened, that I just didn't know conceptually what was happening until I was much older. But then all of this shut down emotional anguish just got channeled into, like, the divorce was terrible, the child support fights were terrible, and that's where I've done a lot of forgiveness of my parents, you know, in the meantime, in the last decade that I've been kind of waking up to that. It's just like, oh, they weren't the worst parents in the world. They were not aware that they had a child who was secretly, even to herself, just broken open. And again, I'm referring to being really sensitive, like a clairvoyant, that was such a damaging experience with my grandfather. I mean, I think it's horrifying. Many of us are survivors of sexual abuse, but it's, again, it's hard to cognate. Like, why was that such a big deal? Well, it was for me. So the next paradigm that's really a part of my story is that I was never safe in social situations. I'm regressed. It's still not that safe for me. Maybe I'm being more honest about it, but going to school was really traumatizing for me. I loved going to school because I didn't want to be around my mother, or she wasn't around anyway, so it gave me a function and a place to achieve, and teachers were very parental and loving to me, and I always think about them as angels, but I was uncomfortable and incapable of being around people, and I was also, with our earlier speaker, the identification of being a people pleaser is really common in Al-Anon and ACA. I don't know if it's prevalent, but I hear that a lot, and I don't have that problem. I might have it in a subversive way, but people may have heard me share this in meetings here. It's like, I'm into displeasing people. That's my coping mechanism. It's extremely antisocial to the extent that I believe I'm on the sociopath spectrum, which just means out of survival, I lack empathy, and I act really reptilian. You know, when the going gets tough, I'm all about, you know, I don't want to get fucked with. And if you even show me that you're going to offend me or affect me in some way, I'm already ready to go. It's all wound up and ready to fire. And I've been, you know, verbally, physically, emotionally violent to others throughout my life. And really bright, so I didn't get busted in school the way that some of the tyrants did. I got squeaked through on those aptitudes, and that's part, again, my story is confusing even to me. My mom, I moved away from my mother onto, is it like a fire alarm? We all have to run upstairs.
Something to do with the coffee.
Okay.
I'm going to see what I can do.
I don't want to go back up there with all those costume people. When I chose to leave my mom's, I'm not really describing all the things that happened that I didn't like. She wasn't home very much. She was doing the revolution, and I was alone a lot, and I didn't know how to feel safe that way, so I wanted to go live with my dad, who was more normal and had a housekeeper and stuff. And I did that for 2 years when I was very young, and then again in high school I just was done. And the reason that's interesting to me is that when she didn't get child support anymore, she no longer could pay rent. And my mom has been homeless many of years since, and we're talking about 37 years now. And she's homeless in another confusing way where she's pretty functional. She lives in her car, or house sits, or dog sits, but I mean, that's the right word, it's the right description. She is right now as well, so part of my, I want to get to the end, I might talk about that. So that kind of, I think the only thing I would say just about my dad is, I think, where I learned a lot of my coping mechanisms of being really guarded with people. So I went from being really broken open by my mom's weirdness. I just can't describe it. I'm writing a book right now about it. Maybe by the end I'll be like able to say, she's a narcissist, I think. And when she recently visited me, I felt like I wanted to get really close to the wall to try to have any space that was my own. And so I sometimes think of her as like an energy vampire where I just get exhausted when I'm around her. And so I don't know what, you know, what she has or what she did, but there's a way that I, like I said, I clung to my dad's coping mechanisms to deal with her, and he really reviled her and thought she was, you know, just kind of an embarrassment that he had a relationship with this woman who's now like homeless and not attractive and all these things. And so I adopted all those perspectives against her. And then I hope it's obvious that those became how I also view myself. The things that also started to happen for me really young is addiction, and I have a severe sugar addiction history that started when I was coming home from kindergarten and going down into where we kept extra food and just binge eating as a 5-year-old. It advanced, it accelerated really fast young, where I was a thief and stole candy bars from the store every day. And so I just mention that because I think now, as having been a mom, that if my kid ate 3 candy bars every weekday, I mean, that would be so horribly against my belief system, because it's so out of balance with the size of a child and what a child's sensitivities are. And so I was really jacked up on sugar to make my life easier. And that was so extreme that by the time I was 17, like alcoholics and addicts that I now know in present time, I was fried. It was over. There was no normalcy left in my life. I was bulimic. My life was all about the next, not like, you know, candy bar, but like the next time I could suffocate my feelings with food. And all I was trying to do was get out of the cycle of purging, which is what bulimia is. You know, there was so much pressure on me once I came out as a bulimic to stop that behavior that my life really, for about 4 or 5 years, was only like, I have to keep eating, I can't throw up, like I can't throw up. And so I had this, I mean, it was a distress, it was a disability to to just manage life where you just have to keep eating. It's a little different than some of the other addictions I'm really familiar with now, because you can't just cut it out. And I think that I was reading a book that there can be a really strong bottoming out period for many people who've had trauma when they're about 18. It looks like when you go away to college, but it's almost like just this moment when it can no longer be mitigated by naivete. And so I really point to going away to college. I went to a pretty impressive college and totally fell apart. People always said, when you go to college, it'll all be better, teachers who were trying to parent me, kind of like when you get away from this. And it was just not true. And it was my last burst bubble. Like, I had just clung to that. I'd get a boyfriend in college. I would feel pretty in college. I would be smart in college. And almost everything was reversed, because everyone was smart in college. Mm-hmm. And I was no longer purging, so I wasn't pretty in my mind. And so sad that my first boyfriend cheated on me. So that was my new imprint when I finally fell in love, that it was just hurt so badly. So I always indicated in my life history that at about 19, when all that crescendoed, is when I became a believer in recovery without even knowing it. I became an in utero, primed for recovery, because life wasn't going to work in any normalcy the way I wanted it to. And I went to my first Al-Anon meeting when I was a senior in college at the Women's Center, all women, and I just feel like it was a bunch of young women telling their stories. I don't know if I didn't work the steps, but I got a taste of that. And the next time was when I was back out of college. I tried every program for eating, Overeaters Anonymous. I wanted to go to AA because it seemed so robust and full of people, and I didn't let myself because I didn't think I was an alcoholic. But now I know from this program that I was so much a para-alcoholic. I had all the, you know, I talk about being displeasing instead of people-pleasing. That was me, like a dry drunk, because I couldn't overconsume alcohol, because what I did when I was drunk was too humiliating. It was a lot of stalking and calling boys that I liked, you know, and just completely blowing my cover in this, you know, inebriated state. So there was no desire to keep doing that every weekend. Like, I learned really fast that that wasn't a safe way to lose myself. And so I haven't had a struggle with drinking too much, but I so identify with the kinds of characteristics that I see in alcoholics. And when I said I go to a meeting every day, or not every day, but it's AA, I go to AA now. Yeah, I'm just sort of moving through the timeline, but I'm going to jump a bunch of time in a second. I want to always get to, I didn't stay in program. I got a little healthier somehow. I think it was maybe overcoming the binging and finally getting sea legs for being a more regulated eater. But I also got pregnant, and that was different than my family expected. I went to an Ivy League college, so you can see I was kind of on this track. And then all of a sudden I got pregnant with a man I met working at a bar. We both worked there. And it was like a derailing of any idea that I was going to pull it together. And I ended up having a beautiful baby that changed my life, because she was the first being I loved unconditionally. I know that's a cliche about being a mom, but holding an infant was truly for me the first instance of a humanization of God. You know, like, I had seen monks, because my mom would take me to see all these countercultural spiritual things, and I felt that vibration, but I never got to keep it. And I think in recovery, you know, basically what I've been aiming for, some of us might articulate it, is just getting a piece of God that's always there, that's our own. So I think about that imprint of holding my infant daughter and feeling preciousness and purity that was mine. Now, you learn when they're a toddler, they're not yours. And that was like, they start going, no! And honestly, that was really rough. It was rough. I wasn't ready. And I say that because I became the parent that we read about in the Red Book. I mean, a big part of my reckoning in going through ACA from the start was like, I have fucked up my kids. And that's the bulk of my program, honestly. It's what keeps me working a program, is that I have to undo it, because I think there's a projection there that I'm basically healing myself from my childhood by projecting onto my kids that they had this horrible upbringing with me. I think they had about half as much horror, and I owe them everything I can to, not really, it's atonement, but it's sort of like making sure these next 40 years we might share where I'm involved in their lives, I've got a way better perspective on how to be fair and kind to them. But it's what motivates me, because I don't love myself enough to do this for myself yet. I'm learning. But that's what I, when I was listening to the first speaker and hearing our first readings, I'm like, I'm just going to get up there and be honest that I'm a work in progress, because I've had real highs in recovery, but I'm going through a time right now where there's a lot of challenge, and in AA they say life on life's terms, and I'm not handling it magnificently. So I'll talk about that at the very end. It's fun. So I raised my kids, and I raised them interestingly with that countercultural picture that my mom gave me woven in. And then the jump start, is that I had a bunch of relationships, not too many, but enough completely crazy relationships with men who are alcoholic or addicts. My only experience in relationship is with men who are active alcoholics or addicts, and to this day. And so that just propelled me into a lot of different kind of adult level reckoning and recognizing how insane I am in relationships. And I never, ever had to learn that it was because of my upbringing. I've known the whole time since I was a child that there was something wrong with my upbringing. But it started to become my life and not my parents doing something to me when I saw how I was acting and choosing to be in love. I've been in SLAA, and that's a really valuable program for me, because from a young age I was fixated on boys making it all better. It's one of the programs that I've gone into and done the steps and then just kind of moved on, and I recommend if anyone is ever drawn to trying programs to give yourself that permission, like we heard Christy say, where you might just be there for a while, but it fills out this picture, because being an ACA and ACA is... It's to me, there's always a stone to turn over about how I've used people, places, and things to kind of fill this giant hole where I didn't know to put God or have God fill. I came into recovery in Santa Barbara 4 years ago. I had done some serious Al-Anon up north when my boyfriend came out as a meth addict, and I just have to tell you that because I went to an Ivy League college and never have done any drug besides pot and mushrooms, I could not believe his secret, and that I was now immersed in this like crazy drug-addled life. But he has been one of the people that allowed me to get out of my superiority complex. Like, I would never touch that kind of stuff. Not just meth, but the life of meth. Like, boy, did he like rub my nose in it and allow me to kind of get off my high horse and see what a lot of Americans do, how it is an addiction. The life of addiction hadn't really blasted through, and now it has. I went to Al-Anon and did great work, and I was allowed to do a geographic and move to Southern California to get away from that situation. My sponsor was all for it, so I don't... And, I think it's true, the geographic is you can't move and not do program here if you want it to work. And I did do that. I didn't do program because it was working so well. Why do program? But 4 years ago, I came back into Al-Anon, quickly into ACA, then SLAA, and worked steps in this program. I did a co-sponsoring, and I did it with three other men, and that was really fun because I didn't have any brothers and I hadn't had enough successful relationships with men who would talk to me about their experiences. I always was with the guys that didn't want to talk about it. And so I got these men that just downloaded. We were, for 9 months, we met twice a week. So it was a huge amount of information in our inventories that we shared. And I got to hear all about how guys get through adolescence and their kind of weird sexual trips that they go on that they're embarrassed about. And I shared mine, and I felt really valuable because they hadn't maybe heard a female with that kind of honesty. And so that's what I always refer to about my experience in ACA is the co-sponsoring and kind of getting out of that sponsee hierarchy that you see in some of the other programs. Doesn't work for me. I was just so absently parented that I still don't know what to do with authority figures. So I love it when I can feel like we're equal, we're coming in our recovery. Even in the other programs, someone has 10 years, or if I have some time, like I'm new to every day, things happen that throw me off and I'm a newcomer again. And then, you know, I wanted to be a little bit honest about why I stopped coming to ACA, because it wasn't because everything was rosy, it was because I cannot handle this idea of kind of recreating the kindergarten room that is, I think it's very prevalent in our community here, that we're going to be playful and together and have fun and games. It just doesn't resonate with me. I tried it and I thought there was a lot of joy, and I'm so admirable, you know, it's admirable to me that people can do that. Like, I'm not saying I don't think you should do it. I just had to be honest that I don't operate that way either, because I was an only child or Northern California, or I'm an artist, writer, an isolator, I mean, whatever. I just didn't want to be, I didn't want to feel like I was always failing at being social, and that's how I felt in ACA. So I knew better than to stop going to program, and that's when I started going to AA in the morning. And what I get over there, just to say something about that for me, is a bunch of people have done a bunch of shitty, shitty things. I'm not sure that's true of every alcoholic, but that's the focal point, is owning that you're the offender. In ACA, I know it's very important for me to have gone through a period of looking at how I truly was a victim of circumstance, but I had owned that victim role and continue to now, still, I slip into that, and I needed to get right with God about, well, I needed to unburden myself of my shame about how I parented my kids. And I think I'm hard on myself. When people hear the facts, I'm like, you know, like I was just a single mom who was, you know, poor and crazy, but it wasn't like just terrible, but I feel terrible about it. And so I keep myself clean by remembering where I came from, and that was being abusive to them. And that, like I told you, my goal is to not be that way anymore. And part of the solution is sometimes just not to be around people, because I simply don't have the skills yet to be comfortable in many, many social situations. I think we're gonna be running out of time soon, so I wanted to talk about now, in the funny way, when things are horrible and hard. I fell in love with someone in the other program who had a relapse and is going to prison now and is in county jail, and I find that really, really hard to integrate. Because it's the ACE, when you see the other ACAs, you see people who are alcoholic or addicted, and I do, but I know that they're just totally stuffing childhood hardship. And the language of our program here isn't dispersed enough necessarily for other people to grab on. I see a lot of people who relapse from addiction and alcoholism as basically not being able to stay sober or clean because it's too painful, because of the Red Book's incredible description of what we go through. And when I sponsor people in AA, I use the Red Book to go through the steps, because I don't know another way. I just feel like you got to get at the depth of it if you really want a chance to live differently. So like I said, I identify most strongly with being an ACA, and the material has made the biggest difference for me to start feeling more free. So I have, you know, someone I really care about who's taking a big fall, and I don't even want to separate from those feelings. That's part of my recovery, is to please people more, you know, like just be more empathic and caring and compassionate. So I'm having a good run there. A few of you know that I have two huskies, Siberian huskies, who have been kind of my recovery dogs. And about 2 weeks ago, I was hiking them because the tide was high, so we couldn't be at the beach in the morning. And they took off, which they don't do that much anymore. And the next call I got after looking for them for a long time was from animal control, saying that my older husky had attacked a llama. And she's been incarcerated as a dog ever since. And, you know, there is so much suppressed rage and resentment and kind of like the compassion that turns to protection of her because of what it must feel like for her to be in dog jail. And then there is me, who's got two people I love, you know, parceled out and under restriction. So I'm looking at that expression again, life on life's terms. How do I stay sane and, as we might say, sober? I'm doing all right. I'm doing all right at that. And that's what I meant. You know, I don't have right now this soaring sense of like, man, when you get through the steps, life is just one cake ride. What I've learned is because of my upbringing, I go towards self-defeating responses to situations. You know, I may not have articulated enough, but I have all that. Shame spirals, PTSD, massive PTSD, which to me is just paralyzing shame and shaking physically from I've done something wrong and I can't go on, I should kill myself. Those are really strong tape loops that I face. But I'm getting better because, you know, I've had a few breakdowns. I've been really rude to animal control, like, ugh. Really rude. I think they all need a program, and I mean, I really do. I don't say that from like a histrionic place. I just think that would be, that explains it. They need a program, and I'm just there. But you know, I haven't worked my program effectively in the sense that I haven't. I've been enraged. I've been crazy sounding, and that's been hard to see again. Was that the full 30? See, that's nuts with me. It's just like went by. But I want to just really emphasize when I talk about my best recovery in here, besides care for my own children, my mom is homeless and I love her. I don't think she's like a teddy bear that I just want to get up all close to and snuggle with at all. But I respect her plight. And I respond to it so differently because not only have I had my falls that simulate hers, but I learned in this program somehow to forgive her. And there was a lot to forgive. And now she's like my kid sister. I mean, she's never really been a mom, but she's somebody that I'm willing to have tag along with me. And I know that it makes a huge difference in her life to not have everything be kind of this opaque failure and a daughter thinking that she's disgusting, which I did for years. And so, you know, I say a prayer and praises for anything that would alleviate some of her suffering. As we heard in the first share, it's so obvious why our parents are mean. So obvious why I was mean to my kids. It's just that generational illness. So I want to affirm all of us who are in here trying to make a difference for either our children or our neighbors or our parents. And thank you, everybody.
Thank you.